Official welcome to everyone to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series this week. And it's a pleasure to have Maria Jose Bustamante with us today from the University of Texas at Austin. She'll tell us about self-talk from numerical simulations, but not only about that, I was informed. We'll see. We look forward to your talk. Thanks a lot, and please take it from here, Maria.
Thank you, Daniel. So as Daniel just said, I'm going to talk to you about that project, but I'm also going to talk to you about other projects that I've done over my PhD, mainly because I was told by Daniel that this was for like also like an opportunity for you guys to get to know just my work, right? So I've actually devoted a lot of time to other kinds of research, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of a feel for other stuff that I've done that I actually, you know, like I'm very proud of, and you know, it's somewhat relevant also for this group. Good. So yes, Maria Jose Bustamante Rosell, I'm a PhD student at the University of Texas at Austin. My advisor is Aaron Zimmerman. Right. So in this talk, I'm gonna talk to you at the beginning about a project that I did analyzing the I did a dynamical analysis of the distribution of mass in a dwarf spheroidal nearby, Leo 1. And we found some interesting things in there. So I'll talk a little bit about that and how that came to be. Then I'm going to talk about what I promised I would talk, which is self-torque from numerical simulations. So we're going to do a little bit of review of just like geodetic precession and just the self-force analytical framework. And then we're going to talk about a particular scalar observable that we get from self-force and how and that links directly to self-torque and how we compare that to numerical simulations. And specifically how we can get from numerical simulations further order in the expansion of self-force on this scalar. And we're gonna go a little bit into the details of how we found behavior that we didn't expect and how we kind of like, you know, how I realized, okay, this must be because of, you know, something related to the simulation, you know. So I'll explain the behavior and then we'll go, yeah, I'll show you the results and I'll talk a little bit about future directions. And then finally, if I get some time, I like briefly discuss other projects that are also, I think, of particular interest to this group, but just very briefly. So if this seems a little bit overwhelming, it's just an hour of your time. It was a long, it's 6 years. It was overwhelming, but I think I'll try to make it not so overwhelming. So specifically, let's start with the dynamical analysis of the enclosed mass of the dwarf galaxy Leo 1. So why I was interested in this is due to something that you might be well familiar with, which is the Korkos problem. So this is a problem which arises from comparing just collisionless cold dark matter simulations with observations. So if you compare just cold dark matter simulations with no variance in it, the halos that those dark matter simulations predict have a cuspier core than observations. So actually, yeah, in the central parsecs of those halos, observations basically see a flat distribution of matter, right? Like, but of density. It's just, yeah, the density is flat in the central parsecs, whereas in cold dark matter simulations, we actually see like it kind of like cusps up. Now, people have tried to bridge this gap. They've actually thought that, I mean, some people will tell you that this problem is already resolved and this is just a matter of baryonic feedback. So, and then like just the stars and the gas and whatnot, it's like kind of like flattening the potential in the center of these galaxies. But from the observation side, like you can try to probe. Like what we decided is to probe this once more, but like and do a very thorough analysis. So we decided to choose dwarf spheroidal galaxies to probe this problem. Dwarf spheroidal galaxies are galaxies that are pressure supported, and you find that there's like a bunch of them around galaxies like the Milky Way. and this, which are rotationally supported, and this dwarf spheroidal galaxies are just orbiting, you know, the Milky Way. They're actually really nearby, so they're dark matter dominated, and because they're nearby, we can get stellar kinematics like one at a time, you know, for individual stars. So we can probe the specific dark matter content of the galaxy to a much higher resolution than you would otherwise. For this project specifically, because this is a galaxy that already has been studied in the past, we chose the velocities of different galaxies that were out there in the literature, which are all the green circles. And we placed our instrument in the very center. We took velocities on each of the points that, on each of the circles that I overlay here. And so basically we did this by taking the spectra of all the light that fell into one of the circles, which is what you see here in the right. And that spectra, depending on the velocity of the star or on the velocity of, you know, like the star or the stars that fall into one fiber, will be redshifted right to the right or to the left, depending on whether it's going towards you or far away from you. So we did this with the hope that we would probe into the very central parsecs, like the central parsecs dynamics. And we didn't just do that, but we decided to just overall improve the way that people have been doing this. We took a close look at whether the galaxy, to what radius could we actually talk about this galaxy, because, you know, the radius at which this galaxy has been entirely disrupted and the stars don't actually move according to the central potential, but just, you know, due to an interaction perhaps of that galaxy with the Milky Way, is a thing that is not clearly understood yet. So we just choose different tidal radii to make sure that our conclusions were strong. We also did basically a brute force approach on what was the dynamical analysis of the potent of the velocities that we found. We kind of like Monte Carlo different potentials and put different orbits around those potentials and figured out what matched best our observations. And this is a brute force computationally very expensive approach, but it does much better than just like the naive approach that is normally assumed for these galaxies. Which is mostly analytical. And then we also, and most importantly for our result, I looked closely into the observations that had been done before for the central parsecs of this galaxy and realized that we had a crowding problem. And not only us had a crowding problem, but prior observations had a crowding problem, which was biasing the results about the central potential of the galaxy. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. So here you have a picture of, you know, like this is a picture that has our fibers as they would be overlaid on the sky. And behind is a picture, our archival picture of SDSS, of the light that would be falling into each of our fibers. If you take not archival SDSS image, which doesn't have such a great resolution, but was mostly available for many years in the past, and go to Hubble Space archival data, then you realize that each of our fibers is actually picking up the light from more than one star. It's at least at the very center. This is a problem that didn't just bias our observations, but I guess the main realization of our project was that this was also biasing the observations of anybody working with this galaxy at those radii. And the effect of having the light being contributed by many several stars on one individual fiber is that you essentially have something like a central limit theorem problem, right? Like you're going to be stacking the spectra of different stars all together in such a way that the resulting spectra is going to be less redshifted from the central velocity of the galaxy than each individual spectra or each individual spectrum would be. So, right. So here I'm representing the, like, say, like an emission or an absorption feature, it doesn't matter, of one of the spectra of the galaxy of a you know, theoretical line in one of the stars. And then you see, like, there's a little this one has a little redshift to the left, and this one has a little redshift to the right. And overall, if you add them all together, you'll have something that it's much closer to the central velocity of the galaxy. So the effect is that all of these fibers basically measured a velocity that was closer to the central velocity of the galaxy, which meant that the quantity that we use to estimate the potential of the galaxy, the mass content of the galaxy, was biased towards lower values. So to the right here, just to give a better idea of how this works, this is archival data that we that all the velocities from the different points that I showed in the image overlaid on top of Leo 1, right? Like all the different green circles. And this is the maximum flux contribution that you get on each of these fibers from the maximum flux contribution that you get from one individual star. So for instance, here you would get that the brightest star only contributes to 30% of the total light that that fiber is seeing. Here it's 90%. And as you can see, there's less of a dispersion the less flux that you get from the brightest star, there's less of a dispersion, and the more flux that is from the brightest star, there's a bigger dispersion. So we use the dispersion as a proxy for the enclosed mass. So we take different radii, and the dispersion should tell us if you have a higher dispersion, then you have a higher enclosed mass. So you can see that this systematic basically would be biasing our observations to a lower enclosed mass. And this is not just our observations, this is also archival observations. So we basically, well, I mean, I basically realized this and I said, well, okay, so then these people have been underestimating the amount of mass that you have in the central parsecs of this galaxy. Let's try a different method to solve this problem. So I went ahead, tried a different method, which actually make use of this new information to try to estimate the velocity that was actually, the dispersion of the velocities that was actually in this galaxy, right? Like at different parsecs. And essentially, we found a really, really massive black hole in this galaxy because of this. This is a black hole that is the size, in solar masses, is about the size of the Milky Way black hole, the Sagittarius A. And it's a striking feature, really, because dwarf spiral galaxies are not supposed to have supermassive black holes. So this means that, well, this has a bunch of consequences. It has a consequence just for, like, if you think, okay, even if this is a one-off and it's just like a really weird dwarf spiral galaxy, this is a dwarf spiral galaxy that is really nearby the Milky Way. So in terms of like LISA rates, for instance, for M-rays, it already will be a problem, a potential problem, or like, you know, a source of a really bright like set of M-rays. Then on the other end, you also have that this, that if this is not a one-off, then that means that perhaps other galaxies have had this, you know, this bias in the observations. And if that is the case, then our whole idea of like hierarchical formation of galaxies would probably have to be revisited. So it was interesting, and we're about to like publish this very soon. It's in a review process. So that was one of the things that I put a lot of work on.
And Maria, can I quickly ask a question?
Yes.
So I vaguely remember there was some discussion like 1 or 2 years ago about these mass estimates from some dwarf galaxies. And so I think the argument was that from the velocity dispersion, you would overestimate the mass because some of the dwarf galaxies could be tidally excited by interaction with the Milky Way. So that essentially some of the velocity dispersions are essentially tidal excitations or so, if you want. And so that you would sort of systematically
Estimate, yeah.
overestimate the actual mass of the central black hole, but also of the dark matter potential of those dwarfs. And so I was wondering, is that something that one needs to be concerned about here for this particular LEO-1 galaxy?
Right. So the tidal dispersion, so the tidal that problem, tidal disruptions, tidal actually doesn't really affect so much the central parsecs as it affects the outskirts. So it does it has a bigger implication for like the dark matter distribution of the galaxy, your inferred dark matter, than it does
I
for
see.
the central parsecs. Because like the idea is the further you go from the central from the center of the galaxy, the more stars th that the more of the percentage of the stars that you're seeing is actually tidally disrupted. The idea is like if we're going like really cent like right, if you're just focusing on the central parsecs, it actually doesn't matter. And we tested this hypothesis actually. We tried different tidal radius and like the mass of this black hole at least, it doesn't get affected by that. The reason why we find this black hole is more because of the crowding problem, which actually biases you the other way. Biases you to infer a lower potential, a
Right,
lower
I see.
gross mass.
Do you mind if I interrupt again?
Yeah, no, please.
So I think I understood what the crowding problem is, but I'm not sure I understood how you overcome it. Can you
Oh, right.
just
That is
say
because
a
I
bit
didn't
more about that?
actually. That is because I didn't actually explain that part. So you're right in not having understood how we overcome it. So mainly, so we did two things. First, we did a Monte Carlo simulation to try to estimate how big the problem was for prior observations. So we just assumed different dispersions, and given that we knew and we had archival data on from Hubble, right? Like so on at least the distribution of magnitudes and position of the different stars, we kind of like Monte Carlo'd what would actually be the bias for each individual fiber. And we did that. And so then we kind of like estimated with no huge error bars, but estimated in which direction it was going and more or less what would have been the real dispersion if it just from the fact that we were measuring many stars at one time. So that was, but that was just to make sure that we were in the right path. But then we actually took kinematics ourselves. And the way that we took the kinematics now, we kind of like discarded the hypothesis that we could take the velocity of just one star at a time. And we used another way to calculate a dispersion, which is a way that people normally use for star for galaxies that are actually unresolved, right? Like galaxies really far away when you can't measure the velocities of individual stars. And then what you do is you measure the width, the widening of the lines from what you would expect if it was just one star. If you stack many spectra of stars together that have different redshifts, you're gonna end up with just like wider lines from this effect. And that's how people measure the velocity dispersion in right in systems where you can't resolve individual stars. So we literally just applied that same thing. We got something that matched our Monte Carlo estimations. So both approach were just told us that we had the same dispersion and we were satisfied with that. And then we proceeded to our analysis.
Okay, I see. Thanks. So the error bar is dominated by all of that. Is it? It's more systematic than statistical, I would assume.
Yeah, the error bar is just Yeah, it's because we had to bunch up like a bunch, like in order to do this measurement, we had to bunch up, we couldn't do like individual stellar kinematics anymore. So we had to bunch up about, you know, like individual annali of stars. So, I mean, I think it mainly came from that. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, good. So that was one, our first project. That was a very exciting project. And then hopefully, we'll, you know, people will follow on that one. And now I'm going to talk to you about a project that is a little bit more akin to what I think you guys normally work on, right? So it's self-torque from numerical simulations. And in order to talk about this project, right, and this relates to an effect in general relativity that, you know, it's really well known. It's, you know, as old as general relativity, which is the fact that if you have a test gyroscope and it's in an orbit about a big massive black hole, then that test gyroscope will see its spin precess about the orbital angular momentum. And this is an effect essentially just of the fact that the spin is like a vector. It's a vector that it's moving in a curved space. So you have a kind of like something that will be akin to a parallel. So if you were to parallel transport a vector in a curved space, you know, if you close the loop, you essentially, a definition of curvature is that the vector will not be pointed in the same direction as it started. So it's related to that. And this essentially sets a precession frequency. Now, this precession frequency has been measured and, you know, solved for in different limits. So in the weak field limit, we have that the precession frequency is directly proportional to the velocity and the gradient of the potential, the gravitational potential. And it has been measured to a 1% accuracy by a satellite, the gravity probe B. So, I mean, we have that limit, but then it has been also, this precession frequency has been also calculated exactly for the Schwarzschild spacetime, in which is directly proportional to the orbital frequency. But the question arises, what happens to this precession frequency as you go to perturbed spacetimes? And also, why do we care anyway? And the main thing is, within the context of the two-body problem in general relativity, we have an analytical, you know, a perturbation, an analytical perturbation that goes in orders of mass ratio. And this analytical perturbation is called the self-force approximation. And it basically gives you, it starts with the Schwarzschild spacetime and then kind of like figures out the perturbation to the metric due to the existence of a black hole that actually does have a mass. And you know, it's changing the metric from being Schwarzschild to something else. Now, this test particle has, like, if you were to consider this test particle thinking that you are moving in a Schwarzschild spacetime, then you're going to see something that is deviating it from geodesic motion in Schwarzschild. And that is, that looks like a fictitious force. And it's a force that happens due to its own, you know, its own gravitational potential, or like it, yeah, it's its own gravity. And then like we kind of, that is where the name self-force comes from. And in the self-force approximation, people, what they do is they like take this perturbative expansion of the Schwarzschild and they can read, you know, describe the dynamics in terms of geodesic motion in the full spacetime, now including the perturbations. Now, why do we care about this? And why have I, you know, talked about this problem? Well, essentially, it's a really old problem, sure, but only recently have people in the self-force community identified that there is a bunch of scalars, a bunch of scalars associated with this problem that are nice because they allow us to compare self-force with, for instance, with numerical relativity calculations. And like there's, yeah, in the context of the two-body problem, there's a few problems like, I don't know, Emery's and stuff like that, that you would really want to nail down and make sure that you have a way to compare numerical relativity simulations to self-force, or perhaps self-force to, like, I don't know, like other forms of approximations like post-Newtonian and whatnot. So one of the quantities that self-force has as a scalar observable is the rate of precession, which essentially is how many radians of precession do you accumulate per radian of orbit. And this is particularly right. So in this regularized metric, in which you are considering a perturbation to the Schwarzschild spacetime, you will get corrections to this scalar that predicted by the self-force approximation. Now, in the 2014, Dolan et al. Calculated the first order correction to this precession rate. And that was, yeah, that was, I think to date, yeah, no, I'm sure to date, nobody has calculated the second order correction to this precession rate. Now, we, given that we have, are members of a numerical relativity code, right? Like a collaboration that has a numerical relativity code, then we thought, oh, well, you know, maybe we should just run our code, actually solve the Einstein's equations and get an estimate for the second order term in this perturbation series. And we did so. So we embarked on this idea, having an expectation for what the precession rate should be. And basically we just expected that the body was going to be precessing, and it's going to be precessing with a particular frequency that would just be increasing, increasing, increasing as it went closer and closer to merger. Now, then we decided, okay, you know, let's set up our different our different simulations. We simulated 9 binaries with 3 different mass ratios and 3 different spin magnitudes. And overplotted here is the behavior of the different components of the spin. Now, in blue, you have the all the x components of the spin in the with different magnitudes. So they are overplotted. Then, of course, in orange, you have the y components, and in green, you have the z components. As you can see, at least from the very first few precession periods, cycles, you see that there is an increasing frequency as the orbit gets closer and closer, as the particle gets closer and closer to merger. Now, as you may have already noticed, there is an additional frequency present in each of the components of the spin. And it was a little bit puzzling, and perhaps you have an idea of why that could be right now. I don't know, perhaps you think, well, I mean, what we thought originally was like, oh, perhaps this is just like a mutation, right? But it so happens that at least the, you know, just mutation, which is just due to the coupling of the spin with the orbital angular momentum, should really depend on the spin magnitude. And here you have a plotted different magnitudes, and they all see exactly the same behavior. So it couldn't have really been that. Was there a question? Sorry.
No, I was going to ask you, so what's a period? I mean, there seemed to be a definite period. And could you relate with anything, any of the physical parameters?
Yeah. So this period, if you go just to the Schwarzschild case, which I think it's easier to understand, then this is the precession frequency, right? And this is it's directly related to the orbital frequency, but other parameters of like the mass of the black hole that is making the Schwarzschild spacetime. And so
I'm talking about this other feature that you're referring to.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, you mean like this mutation frequency? Yes.
I don't know what that is. That's what you were asking. You were saying that you don't really know what it is. So if we don't know what it is, it was at least to try and get some sense of what the physical period is. And then one can kind of see what might be connected to.
Right. So the period seems to be connected to the orbital frequency. I don't want to say much more about it because that's the whole puzzle that we're going to solve in this talk. But yes, but you know, it's connected to the orbital frequency. It's not directly the orbital frequency, but it is, you know, connected to the orbital frequency. Right. So just to give you like a better intuitive idea of what's going on, this was our expectation. It was, this is the free PN precession frequency as I plotted earlier. And over plotted here, we have those modulations that you saw in the spin. Now they are much more clear because they're directly on the precession frequency. And perhaps if this is not intuitive, what that means for, you know, like the orbit, what that means for the spin itself, I did a little video, a parametric plot of the different components of the spin as this curve evolves. So you can see that even though the spin is still, you know, undergoing some circular motion, it's still like, yeah, like it's still precessing in the cone. The what's going on, it's kind of like accelerated and decelerated the rate at which it covers the precession cone. Right. So that's essentially the kind of behavior that we're going to be trying to describe. Now, this behavior is also, as I said, and I just reinforce, is qualitatively different from nutation because nutation depends on spin squared effects, and that should vary with the magnitude of the spin. And it should also have a component that is perpendicular to the precession cone, and we don't see that. Okay. So what is going on? Right. So in order to actually understand what's going on, we decided let's actually like describe the behavior, you know, carry out the equations that describe the evolution of like a massive body with a spin, like a massive body spinning in four space time. So we first set up the spin supplementary condition, and we decided that we would set up the spin to be perpendicular to the four velocity. Then with this in mind, we in the limit of small spins, we had the Madison-Papa-Petro equations, which basically ended up being this is the geodesic equation. So yeah, the orbit is moving in the small orbiting black hole is moving in a geodesic, and this is the spin transport equation. Now, if you decide to move in a frame in which the test black hole is moving, right? So you're co-moving with a small black hole, then your four velocity will become entirely temporal, and then your spin will be entirely spatial. You can solve for this equation in a more evident way, and then you realize that the spatial components of the spin are just undergoing regular precession about the orbital angular momentum. So that's good. That's what we expected. But this behavior means that you are, as I said, in the frame of reference, co-moving with a particle. Now, that is not the simulation frame. The simulation frame is out there at infinity, and it's fixed. So in the simulation frame, the smallest black hole is actually moving. And you can imagine what that means is, well, kind of like exemplified in this cartoon. We have that originally at some point in the orbit, the spin is going to be perpendicular to the direction of motion. But then eventually, as the orbit evolves, the spin will have a component that is parallel to the direction of motion. So it will be boosted in that direction. Now, perhaps now to fully understand this, what we decided to do is just make a toy model that's closer to self-force than anything in a Schwarzschild spacetime. So we set up the four velocity of a circular orbit in Schwarzschild coordinates. And then we calculated the components of the spin in this co-moving frame. And we found out, no surprise, that it has the precession frequency that, you know, people already like have discovered. This is the one that I put in the first slides. Now, if we move to a stationary observer tetrad and we transform to a frame in which the gyroscope is moving, this is in polar coordinates. Now we can see that the components of the spin in this toy model, they pick up a boost in the azimuthal direction. And also you get a component of the spin in the temporal direction. And so essentially the magnitude of the spin will not be constant anymore. You'll get part of it just projected out into time. And then you also have that the spin orbit should resemble an ellipse because it will be boosted in one of its directions. We can also, you know, change this to XY coordinates, which is the coordinates that the simulation actually like directly gives you. And in that case, now we can see, you know, with a little bit of manipulation, but you can see from here that the precession has frequency components that are both at the precession frequency commoving with the small black hole plus the orbital frequency, and also components a second frequency that is like the precession frequency minus the orbital frequency. So great, like, I mean, we've basically reproduced, at least in this toy model, the same behavior that we saw in the different components of the spin. And we call this frame nutation, which is, yeah, the precession will stay on the precession cone, but the rate will vary. Again, what I showed. But again, this is still the test particle limit. And now we have to go to a simulation, which will, of course, no longer be in the test particle limit. So in the simulation, we're going to choose a different tetrad, which is going to be akin to polar coordinates. We're going to, our azimuthal direction will be the velocity unit vector. This is a circular orbit. Then the radial direction will be the acceleration towards the center of mass. And then we'll have the normal to the orbital plane as the other direction. And the spin in our simulations, we're going to mainly put it in the orbital plane because we want to see the effects as maximized as possible. Now, just akin to what I explained earlier, what I showed you in the polar case, you have that the component that is radial, like the component that it's parallel to the direction of motion, will acquire a boost in that direction. So this is just like our model for what's going on. And right, this is just the phase because the frequency is changed as a function of time. And this we don't care about because, you know, this doesn't change anyway. Oh, whoops. Okay. So, okay, good. So we're almost ready. We're almost there. But spec, our code, actually only knows the direction of the spatial spin. It knows the magnitude of the force spin, but only knows the direction of the spatial spin. So in order for us to get the precession rate, we kind of like have to, you know, cross product the perpendicular part of the spin, or like the direction perpendicular part of the spin, well, to the rate, the time derivative of that part of the spin. And yeah, anyway, and take the right, and then we'll get actually the precession rate. But this, I haven't actually put the expression here because it's somewhat complicated and it doesn't elucidate anything, but it does give us that there's several ways to compute the precession rate from the data, from the curve that I showed you earlier. And so if our model for what's going on is right, these should all be similar to each other. So one would be the average of the precession, the other, and the average of the precession, which should be equal to the orbital frequency minus the angle covered over the period, and then also the orbital frequency minus the average of the geometric average of these two quantities, where here you have the upper envelope of that, like, you know, yeah, that curve that I showed you, and this is the lower envelope. And just to make things clearer, what I'm talking about here is this is the upper envelope of the precession frequency. This is the lower envelope. And this is just like one period of oscillation So all of those measurements should agree between each other to reproduce this curve. And voila, they do, which is good. and this is just like they differ between each other within like a percentage or so. Like I guess the period doesn't do as well, but the geometric average and the average and the envelope do fairly well. And great, good. So now that we actually know what is going on with the numerics, or that we're more confident and then we can reproduce the behavior, we can extract from the numerics the precession rate, psi, and we can compare it to post-Newtonian or cell force. So here I'm showing you the difference between the precession rates from numerics and from post-Newtonian, or from numerics and from cell force, and as a function of orbital frequency. So you can see this is the solution. Well, this is for one simulation in which we put a mass ratio of 2. And post-Newtonian, this is post-Newtonian up to 3. This actually, I should have put that, it's 3 pn. Post-Newtonian does really well. And the zeroth order cell force threshold doesn't do so well. The first order cell force, actually even worse. But this is not to be, this is, I mean, this is fine because it's just a mass ratio of 2. This is not the regime in which cell force should be perfect. You know, it should actually tell you what's going on. Now, if we go to higher mass ratios, we see that, like, you know, our estimates from cell force start improving. And we go to even higher mass ratios, so we see that at least the zeroth order in cell force kind of like goes a little bit higher than we expect, but then like the first order corrects in the right direction, but kind of like overcorrects. So there's that. Now we have 3 different mass ratios. So we can in principle fit a polynomial at every frequency, and we can get an idea for the different coefficients of psi, the rate of the precession rate. And that's what we did. And in the next plot, that's what I'm showing. Great. So this is the plot of inferred psi, the different coefficients of psi from numerical simulations. So you can see that the first coefficient agrees really, really well with Schwarzschild. The second coefficient agrees somewhat, I mean, at least agrees somewhat well with the gravitational cell force. But it does have this oscillatory modulation on top of it. We think this also, as you can see, increases with the orbital frequency. It might be that we're not accounting for something and we still have to investigate that. We investigated whether it is a known fact that that the center of mass of numerical relativity simulations actually drifts during the simulation. So we thought perhaps was that, and we fixed it, we corrected for that, but it didn't really do much. So it can be that. So we've, you know, we're still working on that one. And then, but anyway, the main punchline of this is that we actually got estimation, or like a prediction for the second order cell force term from numerical simulations, which is this curve here.
Oh, sorry to interrupt, but can you go back to the previous slide?
Yes. Of course.
So what you've told us here is that for all the mass ratios you've tried, the cell force does worse than the test particle limit?
Right. The first order in cell force is correcting in the right direction, but the test particle limit, it's actually doing fairly well, actually.
Right. That's what I'm sort of pointing out. I mean, I'm sort of disappointed with this. I mean, so I would have liked the cell force to do better than the Schwarzschild result. Have you tried games of, you know, instead of using Q, using the reduced mass ratio, you know, the sort of thing that people do to try to buy accuracy for free?
Yeah, we have, but it
doesn't work.
Yeah. No, it doesn't work. we also tried like a higher, we are running simulations with higher mass ratios, but they're just taking forever. As you can see, it seems that it as you increase the mass ratio, of course, it's improving, right? It's just that these are really small mass ratios. There's that problem as well, right? Like, I mean, we're not really in the regime still of like self force. But as you were saying, I mean, you can do those tricks and it somehow seems like self force works, right? Even when you don't have such high mass ratios, but somehow in this specific example, it's not working so well.
Right. Yeah. I guess an issue here, I think I've lost track a little bit of this over. So part of this is extracting spin information from the numerical simulation. And mm-hmm. I guess there's always a danger of introducing systematic errors in that extraction, right? And I'm not sure how the state of the art has evolved over the last 5 years or so, but it used to be that spin was very crudely estimated in numerical simulations.
Yeah. So you at least in our simulation, I don't know about others, you have a two-pronged approach, right? Like, so the direction of the spin. So on one end, you have the magnitude of the spin, which sure, you know, you calculate aside, but this is the force spin. And then you want to calculate the direction of the spin, the spatial spin, right? And you, those are the only two quantities that the simulation gives you. So it doesn't actually, right, it kind of like assumes, right, it doesn't give you the full information of the spin. And the way that they get the direction of the spin, if I understand correctly, it's from the extrinsic curvature. You get the extrinsic curvature, and then you have like a density of angular momentum on it, you know, like because the thing is spinning, so you can calculate the density of angular momentum, gives you a spin function. And essentially you take like the dipole moment, and that gives you the direction of the spin. So I mean, is it good? Like, you know, right? Like, I mean, that's our approximation for the direction of the spin.
Right. No, and I understand that this is the best that can be done, presumably, but I still don't know how this maps to the actual spin variables that people would use in post-Newtonian descriptions or self-force descriptions. So there's always a danger there that there's a mismatch between numerical relativity and the other descriptions.
Right. I mean, I guess the whole point of this, I guess, was that this is a scalar observable. So like we're actually comparing the same thing, apples to apples, right?
That's the hope. That's the hope.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
You said something that maybe if I quote you, it's a known fact that the center of mass in numerical simulations moves around. What are you referring to there? I mean, is it the center of mass of the full system? Because you have it's not a symmetric problem. So you have asymmetric radiation. So you expect some motion to happen and it's going around. Are you referring to that? Or are you referring to truly the center of mass of the system is not conserved in the simulation?
Well, so the center of mass for the whole simulation, right, like for the two body actually does move. And yes, it is due to asymmetric radiation, but people try to correct for it considering this asymmetric radiation, and they still have a underlying like center of mass bubbling, right? So it's an American, like it's an American error, I guess, because they didn't really fully account for it with radiation. Yeah. I mean,
So you think the error is where? So, because if it is a numerical thing, okay, you could then just try and refine the simulation and then the error will go down or should go down. Or mm-hmm. is there something fundamentally not understood? You say in the
I think there's something fundamentally not understood. I mean, it's not easy to calculate center of mass in numerical relativity, right? Like in relativity in general.
Right. But we know it's conserved in the theory. That's what I'm confused. Because if you are, or if the code is implementing the equations correctly, the center of mass will be conserved. Mm-hmm. And then resolution studies should tell you what the true solution should be provided. I mean, one thing that the spec gang always talks about is that their simulation is so much more accurate than everything else. So I'm surprised that that they don't know yet how to do correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you it's like most of the simulations that we've actually like seen or observed, they just have a center of mass that it's wobbling, that it's not accounted for, because I mean they're trying to correct for that. Yeah. So that definitely does happen.
Is that maybe a gauge issue as opposed to a numerical error issue? Just that in your particular gauge, the center of mass drifts from the origin?
Well, yeah. Like, I mean, it's probably more a gauge issue than anything, because it does have a very, like I'm just remarking, like, it's not like it's just, you know, random walking or something all over the place. It's like actually, it actually, like, you know, makes a little circle or something and then like shoots off. Yeah. It has a trajectory that's really well defined. So it's not a random walk. Yeah. But that's, I mean, I haven't really like carefully investigated the problem, but I can tell you that it looks like it's not just junk. Yeah. That you can refine better. Anyway. Good. So we have this, the second order prediction for the
spin. Oh, sorry. May I ask you? So there is a question here. Do you have a sense of why? So initially, as your frequency is increasing, mm-hmm. that extra oscillatory feature that you have there seems to grow its mm-hmm. wavelength, its frequency. It goes to a lower frequency. Mm-hmm. Do you have a guess of what's going on there?
I'm actually
like everything in the problem is going higher in frequency, mm-hmm. yet this thing is goes in reverse.
Yes. So right, and our just like our expectation, if it was right, perhaps. Yeah, I'm still wondering what's going on. That I pointed that feature because that's definitely a clue to what's going on, but we still haven't figured it out. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So anyways, in future directions, I directly
say, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry to keep interrupting you, but I just had one more question on that plot, uh-huh. the previous
I'll
one.
I'll go back. Yes.
Yeah. So just wondering, given what you told us, that it seems like the self-force calculation is not converging at the mass ratios you're considering, in the sense that the differences get smaller and smaller with mass ratio, if you actually expect to be able to extract like the next order self-force calculation from your results.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, we didn't necessarily expect, we hoped that was the case. We didn't necessarily expect that it wouldn't work. But then at least our first order and our first order and our second order coefficients matched directly what we have from self-force. So we were confident at least that it's going in the right direction, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily so the thing is here, like the PN expansion seems to be doing well, but that is also because the PN expansion actually in like just at first order already has a term that is like order squared in the mass ratio, so it's already correcting fairly well for that, and so that already gives us an idea that that it is like even at this mass ratios we're probably in the right direction, because the PN is also serving as a proxy for what we would have if we include the second order effect with this mass ratio. Yeah. I don't know if that was clear. I hope it was.
Yes, I'm just still a little bit confused. So you're extracting, so like the second order self-force correction is like known theoretically, or you're trying to just extract
it? No, it's not. It's not, right. We're trying to extract it from the simulations, but we know in the post-Newtonian expansion, let me go to the, here. We know the expansion in post-Newtonian of the precession rate, and we know that at first order, it does have a term that it's a second order in the mass ratio. So the post-Newtonian expansion already, like at first, like, you know, like should carry information of this term at least. So we think that it, right, we're kind of like not entirely surprised that it does better, And it also gives us hope to believe that even at these mass ratios, perhaps we can actually get information on the problem.
Okay, so the hope at least is that sort of at second order beyond, it starts to converge once you include exactly. all those terms. Okay, I see. Thanks.
Good. So that's more or less what we have for now for this project. We still need to investigate, as you guys were saying, the residual oscillations. We also were wondering, I mean, if this gamma factor, this boost factor, would be useful, because it's kind of like a direct way to get a tackle at the velocity of the particle, like a geometrical, you know, way to do so. So we're thinking, oh, okay, that might in itself be useful. Then, I mean, finally, just like if we were to simulate more and bigger mass ratios, we would get a finer refinement of our second order self-force result. And last but not least, there's people also who within the simulating string space-time collaboration have tried to tackle this problem. And, you know, we still need to compare properly what we did with what they did and figure out, you know, what they didn't fully solve the issue. So, but we still need to figure out, you know, how these two problems compare or these two approaches compare. Now, I think I have like, I don't know, a couple of more minutes so I can very, very briefly talk to you about other projects, or we could just, you know, continue with questions. This is your call.
Go ahead, there might be questions about the other project. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What? Okay, good. So, so as I also led the electromagnetic follow-up in the McDonald Observatory for gravitational wave sources. So I set up a pipeline to detect gravitational waves with this, like, well, to follow up on gravitational waves from like using this like 10 meter diameter telescope, which has attached to it one of the biggest integral field unit spectrographs in the world. And we, our hope was to get like, you know, really, really, really early on spectra of a kilonova. And so if you get, as you may well know, if you get really early on spectra of the kilonova, then you might get further information on the elements and the features. Further information on the elements that gets washed out later. So we basically pointed this like massive, IFU towards the different directions where we thought there would be a good chance of getting the counterpart. And well, I mean, just as anybody else who followed the second, who followed LIGO on its second run, we didn't get anything, but you know, we weren't worked on this, and that was a fun project. And then finally, this is a project we're exploring, which is actually kind of cool, I think. And this is like measuring gravitational waves with gravitational waves. So Lisa is going to measure the gravitational waves of many, many white dwarfs, like tens of thousands of white dwarfs in the Milky Way, and it will be able to resolve them individually. And our idea is perhaps we could use these waves to measure gravitational waves of different frequencies, because these waves are going to be modulated by the background gravitational waves. So it's kind of like going to be like a radio FM effect on them. And it would allow us to tackle gravitational wave frequencies that are in between what the PTA can do and what LISA can do. So, I mean, at no cost, at least experimentally, right? Like it's just more like data analysis. So that's another project we're looking into. And with that, in a couple of minutes left, this is it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria, for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
We already had quite a lot of questions, but maybe there are more. So I was actually wondering, Maria, what's the field of view of, if you're following up these LIGO events, so with the McDonald Observatory that you just mentioned, So how do you do the follow-up actually? How do you schedule? What's your essentially your approach to finding the counterpart and these kind of things? All this, like how you tile the error box and these kind of things.
Yeah. So we are. I mean, unlike smaller, wider field of view telescopes where you can just like tile up the whole sky, or at least the whole region where there's a high probability. We have to do more like a ranking of galaxies approach, right? Like, so we basically
Something like Swift does or so. Yeah, okay.
Right. So we do the same thing, and we restrict to the first, part of the sky that our telescope can actually see, and then we just go over this ranked galaxies and get spectra. As a really nice byproduct of our search, we get spectra of many different galaxies. So that's nice. Yeah.
I see. That's great. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one. So I know that you ran over this really quickly, but what is the expected evolution in the frequencies of the white dwarf binaries for LISA? Because the people are they really, really good timers. I don't know.
So unlike with the pulsars, right? Like when they're like actually really, really good timers, this ones won't have such a great timing accuracy, but we're banking on the fact that we just are continuously monitoring them, and we have, instead of around 20, we have like 10,000. So it's a numbers game at that point.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big difference in the numbers. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Thank you, Reid. Any final thoughts? Okay, well, if not, then let's thank Maria again for a wonderful talk.